Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
President Biden prepares to name Lael Brainard to lead the National Economic Council. Plus, Blackstone's retail investor pivot leaves it bruised, and why China's consumer-led economic rebound may not buoy the rest of the world enough to prevent a global recession.
The countries and industries that benefit a lot from the traditional Chinese recovery, the investment-led recovery, those are probably the sectors that are maybe going to see less of a benefit.
It's Tuesday, February 14th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here's the AM edition of What's News. The top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Three people are confirmed dead and five others in critical condition after a shooting inside two campus buildings at Michigan State University last night. That is according to police, who said that the 43-year-old suspect in the shooting, who had no affiliation with the university, died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after he was confronted by law enforcement. In response to the shooting, the university said that it would cancel classes and all other activities for the next 2 days. President Biden is set to name Federal Reserve Vice Chair Lael Brainard to serve as director of the National Economic Council, according to people familiar with the matter. Brainard would succeed Brian Deese in the role after he plans to step down later this month. The White House declined to comment. WSJ Markets reporter Joe Wallace has more on what Brainard could bring to the job.
The NSE director is responsible for advising the president on policy decisions and also coordinates policymaking across the various agencies in the executive branch of government. Now that will also include overseeing the implementation of big infrastructure and semiconductor spending packages that President Biden has signed into law. Brainard is an economist with extensive government experience. She served as the top diplomat in Treasury from 2009 to 2013, and before that, she was an advisor to President Clinton on international economics. Continuing in that vein, she could also be tasked with managing the economic fallout from the war in Ukraine.
Turning to Asia now, the Japanese government today nominated Kazuo Ueda to become the next governor of the Bank of Japan. Should Ueda succeed current governor Haruhiko Kuroda, it would mark the first leadership change at the bank in a decade. Ueda has said that he believes Japan's aggressive monetary easing program should stay in place, keeping interest rates down to encourage borrowing and spending. Preliminary ratings are in, and Sunday's Super Bowl drew 113 million viewers, making it the third most watched TV show of all time, according to Nielsen and Adobe Analytics. That strong performance comes as traditional TV viewership has declined, and as other live events like award shows have seen ratings drops in recent years. The Super Bowl also marked a record-setting day for the sports betting industry, according to analysts and sportsbook executives. BetMGM said it saw a new record for total bets placed on the game, driven by the expansion of sports betting in the U.S., which is now legal in 36 states and the District of Columbia. And on tap today, the U.S. Labor Department is set to release its January Consumer Price Index, a leading measure of what consumers are paying for goods and services. December's report showed six straight months of cooling inflation, though prices still rose 6.5% from a year earlier. Quarterly earnings updates are also due today from the likes of Coca-Cola, Marriott, and Airbnb. Private equity giant Blackstone became one of the world's most powerful financial firms by investing on behalf of large institutional investors. But in 2017, it launched the Blackstone Real Estate Income Trust, or BREIT, to give retail investors a chance to get in on the commercial real estate action. However, that big new idea has instead left Blackstone bruised. Wall Street Journal private equity reporter Miriam Gottfried is with us now to explain what BREIT's fortunes mean to the company. Hey, Miriam, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So explain, if you could, the origin story and the sort of initial promise of BREIT for Blackstone.
So BREIT was, as you said, supposed to give individual investors, everyday millionaires, as I like to call them, access to Blackstone's commercial real estate portfolio and prowess. It's what's called a non-traded REIT, which means it's not traded on a public equity exchange, but it acts like a real estate income trust and has those tax benefits. And it was very popular during the last few years. It launched in 2017 because investors were looking for access to that market, which is pretty hard for an individual to get. And they were looking for yield because, remember, interest rates were super low. And this was a time to get some good yield that was pretty steady.
So initial popularity, it sounds like. What went wrong?
Well, it got to be Blackstone's biggest fund ever. It was nearly $70 billion in net asset value. And then the market turned and you had stocks falling, especially in Asia, where Blackstone had sold the product pretty heavily. And people said, you know what? This BREIT thing looks really good right now, but I might need liquidity for other things. And this is one of my few assets that's doing well right now. And it was very appealing, basically, as something that had done well, as something to sell. And the unique thing about this product, unlike a regular institutional product, is that you actually can sell it. Every month, Blackstone offers individual investors the opportunity to redeem their shares. So people did. And redemption spiked, so much so that Blackstone had to limit them, which it's allowed to do per the terms of BREIT.
Finally, Miriam, what is the significance of this sort of turn of fortune for Blackstone and for the private equity industry writ large? Is the experiment in catering products to retail investors over?
I don't think it's over, but it's definitely given people some pause. A lot of Blackstone competitors are looking at this and saying, how do we design our products so that we avoid this problem? And this is really important because catering to retail investors is the story for the next phase of this industry's growth. That is what they're counting on. And it, without being able to do that successfully, their growth is going to slow significantly. It's been one of the fastest growing areas of finance, and they're counting on retail investors to get them there and to keep them going. This has definitely put them to the test, and Blackstone had charged ahead and was the furthest ahead in this. And now people are saying, well, maybe we want to hold off or take it slowly.
That was Wall Street Journal private equity reporter Miriam Gottfried. Miriam, thanks for bringing us this story.
My pleasure.
Coming up, China's economy may be bouncing back, but countries and businesses hoping that China's rebound could send positive ripples their way, well, they could end up disappointed. We'll look at why after the break.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/ITheroes.
The world is counting on China's economic bounce back in order to power global growth and to help keep recession at bay. But economists are warning that for many parts of the world, China's recovery could be weaker than governments and businesses would like. Wall Street Journal Asia economics reporter Jason Douglas has been tracking China's economic rebound, and he joins us now with the very latest from Singapore. Hey, Jason, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Luke. My pleasure.
So tell us, what does China's recovery look like right now?
So far, it looks pretty good. So what we're seeing is consumers are spending again. If you remember, everyone was living under the threat of COVID lockdowns for 3 years. That was pretty bad last year and really hammered growth in 2022. Since they started lifting restrictions in December, we've seen, after a brief lull as everyone got sick, consumer spending has started to pick up again. You hear lots of anecdotes about long queues at restaurants, box office takings are up, travel is resuming, and all this kind of stuff. But what's important for the global economy, though, is that this kind of recovery, one led by consumers, is kind of unusual for China, right? Normally, when China is the engine of global growth, it's led by stimulus and it's led by investment, investment in buildings, investment in machinery, investment in infrastructure. And those kind of investment-led recoveries are very good for the world economy. It has lots of spillovers to the world economy, to use an economist's phrase. So there's lots of demand for commodities, lots of demand for machinery. Any and every input that China needs to sort of power its economy, it will suck in from all over the world. Consumers, on the other hand, Chinese consumers, they tend to be more cautious on spending. They tend to save quite a lot. They will be spending a lot more. They're doing this already, but they will be spending a lot more money on services rather than goods. Services tend to be domestically produced. So that kind of consumer-led recovery in China, a lot of economists think will have fewer spillovers for the rest of the world. And that's what's important this time around.
Jason, just building off of that, who is this consumer-led recovery in China most likely to benefit globally?
Sure. So there will be some beneficiaries, probably some pretty big ones. If you kind of think of regions and countries first, then the kind of places that will hopefully see a pretty decent benefit will be countries that attract a lot of Chinese tourists. So I'm here in Singapore. This part of the world is exactly the sort of place where you'd hope to see some sort of tourism boom. So Southeast Asia, Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Hong Kong in particular, countries that bring in a lot of tourists. That might help Europe in particular as well. Europe is still a very popular destination for Chinese tourists, maybe the US a little bit. So tourism is one thing. Energy producers are another. So if you're ramping up your economy, you will have a greater demand for energy. So there's quite a bit of expectation that China's demand for energy will increase. And then there are sort of niche sectors. So things like European luxury goods retailers, people who make fancy handbags and that kind of thing, the wealthy like to spend money on, I think they're pretty excited about the prospect of a Chinese reopening. In fact, some are already talking about how they're seeing people rush back to their fancy stores and that kind of thing.
Let's take the other side of it. Who is most likely to be left disappointed by this bounce back?
Right. So here it's kind of the countries and industries that benefit a lot from the traditional Chinese recovery, the investment-led recovery, if you like. So German capital goods manufacturers, producers of commodities, of metals, of things that are used to build enormous apartment blocks, that kind of thing. Those are probably the sectors that are maybe going to see less of a benefit from this recovery as compared to the kind of traditional Chinese recovery.
And Jason, given that the story of this Chinese recovery isn't fully written yet, what signs will you be watching for to see if it continues playing out as it has been?
Okay, sure. So one big question you kind of alluded to there is a consumer-led recovery in China is kind of so unusual. There's a big question mark over how durable it is. There's still issues around China's labor market. The housing market in China is still doing very badly, which might kind of keep a lid on spending. We mentioned earlier that Chinese consumers like to save a lot. Just how long a recovery in Chinese consumer spending lasts is kind of the big question. So we'll be looking a lot at spending data, a lot at Chinese imports. And I mentioned the housing market. I think if you start to see some sort of recovery in the housing market, and that's a big if, then that might underpin consumer confidence and give us a bit more confidence ourselves that Chinese consumption is probably going to do pretty well for the whole course of the year.
And how that plays out has a major effect on whether we see a global recession. The stakes here are pretty high, are they not?
The stakes are pretty high, you're right. So yes, of course, the US is slowing, Europe is slowing. The IMF, it was, the International Monetary Fund, reckons that fully half of global growth this year will come from China and from India together. China's about a third, add India in, you get about 50%. So certainly this year, the balance of which economies are in the driving seat is definitely changing. So whether the global economy escapes recession, I think now there are lots of signs that some things are looking better, particularly in when we think about the US and other Western economies, but whether the global economy escapes recession, you're right, it will pretty much come down to China and now India as well.
That was Wall Street Journal Asia economics reporter Jason Douglas in Singapore. Jason, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, could the best place to work remotely in the U.S. be Springfield, Missouri? It is no Hawaii, but the so-called Queen City of the Ozarks does sit atop the WSJ's list of great places to live and work remotely. After survey firm Ipsos conducted a nationwide poll last year to ID the top 10 factors that people said they cared about the most in a remote work location. WSJ careers and management reporter Ray Smith has more on what set certain cities apart.
Through our research, some of the places that are the most desirable are places like Springfield, Missouri, which took number one on our list. and some other areas that might be a surprise to listeners were Kansas City, Kansas, Lafayette, Indiana, Conway, Arkansas. So these are metro areas with maybe 200,000 to 400,000 people, but they have some things going for them that really appeal to remote workers. Proximity to an airport that was connected to major hubs, affordability, high-speed internet, more living space. Those were some of the key things that came up time and time again in why those cities rose to the top.
And to find what might be the best remote work city for you, check out a special interactive remote work location finder that we've left a link to in our show notes. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. Unfortunately, not back with us for our next show will be one of our producers, Mohsin Ali, who for the past 2 years has helped make What's News sound so great. Thankfully, starting soon, he will be producing one of our other journal podcasts, Your Money Briefing, which you should go and subscribe to now if you haven't already. Mohsin, thanks for everything. And with that, I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost-effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.